I want to start by saying a huge thank you for Notion for hosting us tonight. And thank you to Notion's Events and Community Manager, Emily Fernandez. Woo-hoo! All the way in the back for making this event happen, because without her, we would have nothing here, and we'd all be sad. So tonight is the fourth event in our series, Thursday Nights in AI. And up next, we have Dropbox CEO Drew Houston, Pilot CEO Wasim Daher, Replit CEO Amjad Massad, and Quora CEO Adam D'Angelo. And our intent with this series is to provide you all with direct contact with founders, researchers, and policymakers in AI. There's endless stuff that you can read online, but we really believe that bringing people together in person is really different. And meeting and interacting and being able to talk to each other is a really good way to foster new ideas. So this series is co-hosted by Outset Capital and Generally Intelligent. Outset Capital is the fund that I run with Ali and our third partner, Josh. We are backed by the founders of Dropbox, Quora, Replit, etc. And we invest in companies at the earliest stage. Literally, we have invested in someone whose idea was in a Notion doc. We are actively investing, so if you or someone you know is starting something, please let us know. If you've gotten something out of this event, we really appreciate an introduction. And please come talk to us. Ali is full-time on the fund, and myself and Josh, our third partner, run Generally Intelligent, which is an AI research lab. And we work on general purpose AI agents, which we can talk more about on the interface side. We're actively hiring, so if you're interested in learning more, let me know. And of course, finally, thank you to Linus for joining us tonight. So as quick background, Linus is recently promoted to the AI lead at Notion. I don't know if he wanted me to give that away, oops. And Linus is prototyping new software interfaces for augmenting our collaborative work and creativity with AI. He spent the last few years experimenting with AI augmented tools for thinking, like a canvas for exploring the latent space of a neural network and writing tools where ideas connect themselves. And before Notion, Linus spent a year as an independent researcher in New York City. So, quick welcome round of applause for Linus.
Thank you so much for joining us, allowing us to join you since we're here at Notion. Thank you for being with us tonight, Linus.
Thank you, thanks for having me and coming to the space.
All right, let's start with the journey. So Kanjun just alluded to in the introduction. You joined Notion relatively recently, earlier this year. This was after a year spent prototyping and building a hacking on your own. And I think you had been considering starting your own company, or maybe doing research, joining a lab, kind of staying in the more realm of the theoretical. Instead, you chose to join Notion,
where you're encouraged to think high level, but you're also deeply in the weeds of a product used by 20 million users, and everything, good and bad, that comes with that. I'd love to hear more about that journey on a previous podcast, Latent Space. Highly recommend. Sean's over here. You talked about this journey and you said that in the aftermath of a new foundational technology emerging, there's often a period of a few years where the winners in the market get to decide what the default interface paradigm for the technology is. And you pointed out this is similar to the personal computer, same thing with mobile. And maybe that working on Notion AI right now was one of those moments. So for you, tell us about that journey and what helped you reach conviction that this was the place to be at this time.
Yeah, definitely. So I spent all of 2022 prototyping, hacking around on my own, research, whatever label you want to put on it. Before that, I was working a lot of stuff on the side around tools for thought, knowledge tools, note-taking apps. And my interest in AI was more of a recent thing in 2022. I spent most of the year investigating this high-level problem of like, so much of modern life, especially modern knowledge work, is just inundated with like text, walls of text, reading walls of text, producing walls of text, searching through text. There's all this information out there, but it's in what I think is a pretty inhumane form, pretty inaccessible form. It's not like when you look at a wall of a page of text, it's not looking at a picture. You have to like parse it and do this very mechanical, pretty intellectually laborious activity of like parsing through text and trying to figure out what nutritional information is actually in there. And so spent a lot of time building like automatic highlighting, summarization interfaces, tools to navigate text and input information into these systems. Some of it was more interface, some of it was more AI. Some of it I might talk about later. I like to say that that period of that year was like, you're like sailing around in a little speedboat. You have a lot of exploration you can do. You can switch directions very quickly. You can just put down a project if you don't like it and work on something else. You get to meet lots of people, talk to lots of people without being anchored to a larger kind of entity. And so a speedboat's good for exploration and picking a direction. But once you actually pick a direction, you can't actually move a lot of water with a speedboat. You want a larger ship with lots more people, resources, momentum, and that helps you. Once you pick that direction, that helps you actually figure out whether it was a good direction or not. And so for me, part of it was I had some theses that I had come out of the year with around how to build good interfaces for AI and for tools for thought, and I wanted to kind of put them to a test. So that's one reason. The other reason is the sort of second thing you alluded to, which was in the aftermath of a new kind of technology or medium, there are winners that set the paradigms. My thoughts on this have kind of expanded a bit. I think a part of it is definitely the winners set the interface defaults. As an example, like scrolling directions, the concept of like apps in mobile and how they differ from desktop, multi-touch, zooming in and out, things like that. There's so many subtle things that we're just kind of used to that we take for granted for how these materials work, but someone decided them, right? So the appeal of being a part of a team that could potentially set those things in motion, because given Notion's large distribution, was a part of it. I think beyond interfaces too, there's also a larger important thing, which is setting the tone for what kind of relationship humans have with AI. This is a little grandiose, but on Ivan's or CEO's recommendation, I was reading this, I think it's called Make Something Wonderful or something like that. It's Steve Jobs' memoir put together by Steve Jobs Archive. And in one of the stories in there, Steve talks about this moment a week before they launched the original Mac, when he just had everyone in the room and he was like, the Mac is significant because, in part because it changed the color of the relationship people had to computers. Before then, it was kind of this like cool, dark mechanical machine. It was automation. It was powerful. And everyone could kind of see where the power was going. And everyone could see that this was kind of going to be everywhere. But it was not to be taken for granted that that relationship was going to be this like very fun, creative, often humane kind of thing. It was more of a machine in the room. And when they saw that machine, the Mac that they had built, they were like, okay, now that we have this more human, more creative kind of inviting thing, this is so obviously going to be the tone of the relationship that humans should have to computers. And it's not a matter of whether this is going to be the relationship, but how long it's going to take to get there. And I found that really motivating. AI is still kind of weights that run inside data centers. And that's one way things to go. Or maybe there's products and designs and things we can build and messages we can send that set the course to be more like AI is kind of a partner or a collaborator, whatever you want to call it, a more human kind of relationship. And so the chance to be a part of something that pushes the world a little bit in that direction, I think was also really alluring.
Got it. That makes sense. Can I ask, do you feel like there's a default path or that it's like wide open? What's going to land?
I don't. There's a lot of really smart people working in like pushing this in all kinds of directions. A lot of people are obviously working at the like model and training level, trying to steer the tone and the speaking style and these things, models. A lot of people work at the interface level. There's also definitely a lot of valuable work happening at the policy, strategy, regulation level. So I don't know if there's a default path that I would push against, but there are paths that I have like opinions about.
So you mentioned how the Mac set the tone for what was to come. I think kind of implying that maybe Notion is going to set the tone for what's to come with AI. So let's talk about Notion. Many of these people in this room are undoubtedly familiar with what you guys have rolled out already, but can you kind of give us the quick overview of what Notion AI looks like today?
Yeah, so our AI journey kind of starts, I think about 10 months ago at this point, last November of 2022. We first started exploring and we very quickly prototyped together and launched the initial version of Notion AI, which was putting this power of GPT-3 following instructions inside your Notion editor. So you could take a document, pull instruction out, or pull information out, summarize it, pull action items out. You could try to use it to translate things or change tone or help you write or edit. So initially there was a lot of things you could do. We had a brief period of sort of, I guess, preview. I don't know if we called it an alpha or a beta, but a preview period. And then we made it available to everyone in February. And since then we've had a few sort of incremental things on top of it. And so the initial thing, which we sort of internally called the AI writer, was the first push. And then we had made AI blocks, which is a special type of Notion block that you can put inside that has kind of a prompt built into it. And you can use it to update and regenerate information on a page. More recently in May, we launched AI autofill, which is putting AI inside Notion databases. So This is in contrast to kind of writing a single document. This is if you have lots of structured information like 1,000 meeting notes or 1,000 user interviews or people that you're looking at, candidates you're looking at for recruiting, you can take that information, maybe transcripts or maybe notes, and pull structured information out or translate or summarize. So we've taken this initial kind of thing and sort of learning every step of the way to figure out how this new technology that can generate all kinds of content and follow instruction can actually fit into people's workflows that they do day to day. And I think that crossing the gap between like, this is a cool tech demo to this is something that I now depend on for my day-to-day work or is super valuable every time I start a meeting or every time I take notes, that's the like interface gap, right? So that's the general story.
Got it. Yeah, I love the idea of a quick block that can summarize my Notion pages because they are just a disaster. If they're like from a call, just clean all that up for me, please. So as you alluded to, the Notion team has been moving really fast on this, releasing the alpha in November of last year, then opening it up for everyone in, I think, February, and then quickly pushing out new products, the most recent one being AI autofill. I was reading the blog posts that Notion put out when you announced a new feature, and one of them really caught my eye. It said that the number one way people interact with Notion AI is highlighting existing text and asking AI for help. This suggests that most people start by writing their own content and then treat AI as a thought partner and editor. And this was mentioned in the context of actually the Notion team being surprised by this, that people were using it to help them in their work as a thought partner versus just like do their work for them. That's something I've heard from other folks as well. I'm curious, do you think that is a short-term pattern until the technology gets better and gets to a place where it can do work on its own? Or do you think this kind of like augmenting thought partner is going to be the paradigm, is going to be the way that we use AI for a long time to come?
Yeah, I think that discovery is pretty interesting. I mean, personally, one of the more fun use cases that I have for Notion AI is if I see a word or an idea or like an acronym that I don't recognize, I'll just highlight it and ask Notion AI to define it, which is funny because you have this like massive tower of GPUs burning tons of electricity and it's just like, define this word. But it's true. I think this is something that we learned by looking at data, but also by talking to people who actively use AI in their day-to-day work is a lot of times, even if they're writing something from scratch, they'll often get an initial draft going, maybe with the help of AI, and then polish it, do rounds of polish, maybe change wording. Maybe there's something that the AI didn't catch and you want to go back. And so it's definitely a pattern. It's, I would say, more augmentative and accelerating than replacing. I'm optimistic about a future where it's fundamentally, I don't know how I feel about the terminology human in the loop, because it implies this like industrial kind of loop happening. But I'm excited about humans always sort of being the ones steering this interaction or steering this relationship. I think the AI is good for like executing on things, but there always has to be a kind of like tastemaker, right? And I think taste is a word that's thrown out in creative context, but even in like business decision-making, even in things that look really dry, like should we prioritize shipping this product over shipping this other product? Like there is someone sitting there being like, okay, I understand people who use this. I understand the business priorities. I understand like people working on this team. I think it requires, someone's going to have to take ownership for that decision or want to take responsibility or take credit for that decision. AI can make the process of understanding the situation so you make that decision easier. It can help communicate that decision to the right people. It can help update people on that decision. But decisions and all these touch points of like, okay, someone's actually exercising their human taste and their experience to set these things in motion, I think at least for a very long time, going to be in a human kind of realm.
Yeah, in a way you can think about Notion AI as replacing my collaborator. But actually what it's doing is like, people think about, oh, replacing, but what it's doing is it's making my collaborator immediately accessible all the time. So now I use my collaborator way more. And it feels like even with agentic stuff, like things that do tasks, that's what's going to happen too. Like, well, I still want my AI collaborator. I also just want all this other stuff.
Also, people just like to have opinions. Like I have opinions about what I think Notion AI should do and how it should look like. And like, it would kind of suck if I could just automate it away because I still have opinions. And sometimes I will think the AI is wrong. And that's the taste-making part of it. So who's in the steering wheel? I'm excited for humans to stay in that seat.
Are there use cases you've been most surprised about people using Notion AI for, or like a high percentage of people using Notion AI for that thing?
There are lots of little surprising, unexpected things. Lots of people use Notion, but there's a small but very enthusiastic fraction of people who use Notion AI to write fan fiction, which is made really easy because you can just be like, give me a romantic story that involves like Jungkook and Suga from BTS going to the zoo, and like it'll just write it. And then you can like polish it. It's like that process is made 10x easier, right? So just things like that. I think more on the pragmatic side, I've been pleasantly surprised and kind of uplifted by how many people are using Notion AI to translate things. Obviously, there's existing tools like Google Translate, but there's a couple interesting things about how people use Notion, translate in Notion AI. One is it's already in Notion. And so if you're working in an international team, like Notion is an international team. We have English speakers in US and Dublin. We have folks in Hyderabad. We have folks in Japan and Korea. And I got a chance to visit the Korea office early this year when I was visiting my family. And within the office walls, people often speak Korean, and a lot of the docs are written in Korean. But and obviously everyone speaks English to a certain extent, but it's helpful to have the mechanical assistance of like, okay, if I'm translating this long doc, instead of me painstakingly translating every sentence, it can give me a starting material and then I can go back and polish. And in aggregate data too, we see a lot of really enthusiastic users in those parts of the world that use Translate and rely on Translate. The other interesting thing about using translation with a language model as opposed to something more traditional, like a NLP model catered to translating, is you can ask for more nuances and tone to be conveyed in the text. And so I don't know if Jeffrey Litt's here, but he's a researcher friend. And he and I were talking about, like, he's a Japanese speaker. And so he was trying to get some text translated to Japanese or back from Japanese, I can't remember. Japanese, Korean, Chinese, these languages, there's much more of a distinction between like registers of respect when you're speaking to older people or more in more professional contexts. And oftentimes translation software doesn't get that quite perfect. And you, in those cases, you can ask Notion AI, like, hey, can you make this a little more formal? Can you make this more casual? Can you speak like XYZ in certain setting? You could even say like, I'm trying to write an email to my boss and help you translate this. And it'll capture that more of that context than a normal kind of rote software. And so the translations is something I, being an immigrant and a Korean speaker in addition to English, that's something I've been pleasantly surprised by.
Yeah, that's something that's really interesting about Notion and Notion AI, which is that it needs to work in several different languages because Notion works in several different languages. So I think you have English, Korean, and Japanese right now, and then German and French in beta. How does that affect how you think about the product?
And prompting.
I was going to talk to you about my thoughts. So one really interesting place that it comes up is in prompting, because the developers in the room are mostly English speakers, and GPT is particularly good at understanding English because of the training data composition. And so all of our prompts are written predominantly in English, and it would suck to have to rewrite the prompts in every single other language that we support. I remember there was a week before we launched, we had like a general availability for Notion AI, and Simon, our CTO, was literally like full-time prompt engineering for an entire week. One of the things he was doing was like writing few shot examples to make sure that behavior, especially around language following, was really robust. We depend a lot on few shot prompts. In addition to sort of the zero shot instructions in the prompts for language following, we say things like, follow, make sure you're replying in the language that the document is written in instead of the prompt language. Because anyone who's tried ChatGPT will know that if you prompt ChatGPT in a foreign language, it'll respond in that language. But if your prompt is in English and then you give it some other foreign language material, it gets confused. And so rely on few-shot prompts a lot for that and for a few other things as well.
So to be clear, what does it look like beneath the hood then to make sure that it does actually output the language and tone you want?
Our basic prompt is like, summarize this document, follow XYZ kind of rules. And then we say, make sure that the reply is written in the language that the document is written. Our examples are, we have few-shot examples and they obviously vary in topic and material like they should, but they also vary in language. So we have 4 or 5 examples, I think, in our summarization prompt that are like, different documents in multiple different languages. I think one is like a tour guide to Italy written in Italian or something, and another is like something Korean, and examples of summaries. And sometimes we have foreign language speakers in the office and we grab them and we're like, does this sound like a rational translation? Because when I write them, I just like Google Translate and then summarize, and then it might not be right. But that's generally the shape that it takes. And then we have stuff that we've built around evaluation and making sure that when we make changes to prompts, those behaviors still remain in place.
Actually, maybe I should have asked this at the beginning, but quick question. How many people in this room have used Notion AI? Show of hands. Okay, all right. A lot of people here know what the product looks like today. They've tried it themselves. To the extent that you can share, what's coming next? What does the future of Notion AI look like?
I mean, a big part of our effort is still in improving the way that people use current Notion AI. So writer blocks autofill. One of the things that I've been really excited about is the potential to do a lot more with translation, as we just talked about. This is something I like particularly got to feel when I went to Korea and see how people are using it there.
Is there anything interesting and different about how they're using AI in Korea?
To be honest, I mostly stay with my family and then like worked at Notion. So the things that I saw are pretty expected.
Okay, so you're saying the Notion team should send you back to Korea for all expenses paid trip to see how people in Korea are using Notion
AI.
That
sounds like very responsible business spending.
Yes.
One is investing in a sort of portfolio of bets around AI and products around AI. There's a lot that we can do there. Another thing that I think is pretty interesting that we've obviously thought a lot about also is the most enthusiastic Notion users have a lot of their personal knowledge inside their Notion workspaces. And you're obviously aware of what other companies and people and founders are doing in the community, but being able to take more advantage of that data, all the knowledge that you have in Notion workspaces would be really exciting and really valuable. So that's something that we've thought a lot about.
Back to prompting. So initially you were very skeptical of few-shot prompting. What happened?
Few-shot, there's a lot of things that you can't communicate zero-shot or is really difficult. So going back to the Japanese translation thing where you try to carry over expressly, like the specific register of speech that you want to communicate. When you're prompting in English and you're trying to communicate the specific register of Japanese that you want the model to reply, you're like using the wrong tool for the job, right? There's not as much vocabulary available to you. And I think that problem generalizes to other things too. If you want a model to summarize in a particular style that you like, often it's really hard to put into words exactly what style is. There are some interesting tricks around this. Like you can try to get the model to write in the style of a specific person. And that's kind of like an interesting pointer to like a specific spot in the latent space. That's like, here's a style that I like. Maybe you can name multiple people. But in general, it's hard to fully specify the behavior that you want with just zero-shot instructions. And few-shot examples, I think, are a great balance of speed and ease of iteration and getting to a specific style or output format that you can't quite convey in just normal language.
Why were you initially skeptical?
This is probably a very long time ago. I think in the broader scheme of like, how do you customize, you have a base model, how do you get it to perform some particular task in a style that you want? There's a spectrum of things. Obviously there's like zero shot instructions, few shot, there's like LoRa fine tuning, there's further steps of fine tuning, there's RL. And like initially I think I was more inclined to think that the best balance for like building interesting LLM applications is probably few shot or fine tuning. And I think that's still true if your task looks very different than what the model was trained on. So if you're trying to teach the model to output some data in some very specific schema, or you're trying to teach it a new programming language or something like that, then you still need training data and you can't prompt it. And even few-shot prompts are probably not enough. But if you're trying to get it to do things like pull out action items from meeting notes, I think few-shot looks much more promising in comparison.
So you've written about how chat interfaces are not the end-all be-all of interface for AI, which I agree with. But I'm curious, what feels off to you about chat?
I talk about this a lot. I think most people generally agree. I'm looking at the audience to get a vibe check. I think most people generally agree that like chat is probably not
the end game. All right, raise your hands if you think chat is not the end game here.
Yeah, it's like I was-
Hold on, raise your hands if you do think chat is the end game here.
No.
Okay. One hand. I like it. Okay.
Oh, definitely. Okay. Yeah. We'll go back after the event and we'll figure out who's right. Yeah. It's like there's all these people like building the face of God and you're telling me we're going to interact with this being by like texting it. It doesn't seem quite right. My stance on this has also kind of changed in the last few weeks. There's a lot of reasons I think chat doesn't feel right. I think the most general one, and especially in specific use cases for applications like photo editing, words are definitely not enough, right? Like you want to sketch, you want to take full advantage of the canvas, you want to like condition generations, not just on what you want descriptions text-wise, but also like draw XYZ here and so on. So for specification applications, I think it's pretty obvious why chat's not the answer. I think for general things, especially things that remain in the realm of text, it's a little more nuanced, but there's a couple ways that I think chat could be better. One that I've thought a lot about is there's so much like in real dialogue, like this is a bit of a weird dialogue because there's like an audience, but in if I'm like talking to a friend, there is so much context that's around the conversation. Like I don't lock ourselves in a blank room with no walls and no context and ask him a prompt. Like we're usually meeting for a reason. I know what's happened in his life. He knows what's happening in my life. Maybe we're in a meeting that has some purpose. He knows, he sees like what I'm wearing. He sees if I'm tired. In that context, the conversation happens. Or maybe we're like pointing to something. The people that are in the conversation take advantage of the context to be interesting and useful. in something like ChatGPT, you are locked in a blank room with an AI and you're telling the AI to do something. And so there's a lot of context that's not being put to use. To make that more practical, I think in a software application, if you're a writing app, for example, there's still a lot of context. There's like edits that you made in the past. There is information that's already on the page. There's even things like what edits did you make last and like where is your cursor? Do you have something selected? Maybe there's other collaborators on the page. If you're in a kind of richer workspace like Notion, there is like other pages that the page links to. There are people that the page is shared with. Maybe it's like a meeting note and there are like other meetings that are similar to it in the past. And so there's tons of context. And if the AI is able to better take advantage of the context and like look at where you're pointing and things like that, I think there's much less information you have to funnel into the text itself. And I think that's one big challenge with text interface or chat interfaces is you have to funnel all of the context in like a single shot into that chat. And that makes prompting difficult for professional prompt engineers, which definitely makes it intractable for most end users.
All right, just a few last questions and then we'll open it up to the audience. We'll have someone go around with a mic, so please think of questions now. All right, so Notion serves many consumers, but also is really geared towards the enterprise. A lot of AI companies just starting out are not. That is kind of like a Notion problem. How do you think about that?
I don't know if it's a problem.
You're right, opportunity. It's an opportunity that Notion has, that these enterprises have security, privacy requirements, I'm sure many others that I'm not familiar with. How do you build in with that in mind?
It's a really interesting problem to work on. From the beginning, when Ivan and Simon were working on it, we were very clear that our relationship with our customers was not going to change. We have data security and privacy practices in place, and we are still not training on anyone's data. We're not using your data directly to improve any of our models. Your data stays where it is. The relationship that you have with us in as your like custodians of your valuable data doesn't change. A lot of people at Notion also use Notion for their personal work, or for their personal life. I have all of my life inside my Notion as well. And it would really suck if like some of that data ended up in a model somewhere. And so we've really focused on one, being transparent and committed to, we are not training on your data, using it to do any of our engineering, unless you expressly give us permissions to use that data. And that, I think, works well to earn the trust and continue to keep the trust of our enterprise users. That does raise interesting technical challenges, though. A lot of machine learning is about using data to improve model performance and evaluate model performance. And so in absence of cheap but morally questionable user data that you can't train on, you have to invest in other kinds of techniques. And so like one thing that we've spent a lot of time building out internally is synthetic data, generating very elaborate fake Notion workspaces that we can use to evaluate our models and train our models and see how they work. There's literally a script somewhere, you just run it and it like generates a new workspace for like a fake company that we make up and it generates our guidelines for this company and like recent, like whatever product releases. But investing in those kinds of tools and then infrastructure for like evaluating and testing prompts and models on those tools, I think are things that we've invested in so that we won't have to resort to these other kinds of things that we don't want to do.
I'm quite curious about evals because we work on agents that reason in code and evals are like basically one of the core things to understand, like, is it actually getting better? It's actually really hard to tell. For Notion, for generating text, like how do you evaluate if a summary is good or if it did a good job in a certain situation? It seems so fluffy.
Yeah, this is, I would say, at least on the like data and model side, one of the toughest problems that we work on. And it's definitely not solved for us or for the rest of the industry. There's a bunch of different levels where you can talk about whether something that a model is doing is good. And they like sort of go up in complexity. So at the base level, there is like, is the model doing something that's blatantly incorrect? So if you ask a model to summarize something in the right language, if it's using the wrong language, or if the summary is longer than the original text, or it's not on topic, or it's not using the right format, like it's giving you bulleted lists instead of paragraphs and you ask for paragraphs, those are pretty incorrect. And so those, I think you can pretty reliably catch with things that look like unit tests. I know in the community, there's a lot of people working on sort of model graded evaluations where you generate some response from a model and then you ask like GPT-4 if it follows certain sets of rules. And I think that's a good smoke test. And we have things like that internally. Those can only catch kind of blatant correctness. As a total side note, some of the ways that popular language models are tuned make them very chatty and verbose. And a lot of times when you ask it to like summarize a blank doc, it'll write you a paragraph about why the document is empty. And it's like, you can just say there's nothing there. So checking for behavior like that, I think is like kind of unit testy and it's a pass or fail kind of situation. And then slightly above that is if you have other ways of measuring correctness for a particular task, you can measure those things more quantitatively. So maybe an example is like, maybe you have a task that's like, pull out the action items. Maybe you can have a test data set of documents containing action items, and you can check how many of them per example the model managed to extract. And that's a little more quantitative. It's a little more like you're measuring the quality of work instead of the correctness. Ultimately, the arbiter of correctness at the end is always, I think, humans, and there's still nothing that comes close to real putting things in front of real humans. And so when we build things internally, Notion runs on Notion, and we do a lot of dog fooding. And so when we have new features, we'll roll out internally to everybody and see how people feel about it, how people use it, and catch a lot of bugs that way. And then for some features that seem a little more significant, we'll do kind of canary testing. Some portions of our global user base will get new versions or test versions of prompts. And then if they seem to work well, we'll roll it out to everybody else.
All right, last question. We've asked you very targeted, specific questions so far. This is your opportunity. What are you excited about? What haven't we talked about that is exciting to you, either within or outside of Notion?
That's a really big question. There's a lot. I'll settle on three, because rules of three. I'll try to be brief, but if anyone has questions or if you want to talk about it after, I'm happy to. The first is architectures beyond the transformer. Fundamentally, the reason that transformers have been good, and we have this whole AI situation right now, is because we have tons of data we can shovel into these systems, and then we have ways to massively parallel train them. And none of that's really unique to the transformer. The transformer just makes it possible to run these things very parallel. And there have been sort of incremental improvements to transformer, but it's actually quite surprising how closely we adhere to the original transformer architecture from 6 years ago when you look at the modern designs. To me, it's inconceivable that this is like the last possible language model architecture we're ever going to make, right? It's only been 6 years. And so there's other things like state space models improve on the transformers in various ways. There are things that are simpler, I think, with training algorithms too, like RL, that are better approaches or approaches that purport to be better. And so I'm interested in approaches that come after the transformer and what we'll learn by understanding how they work and why they work better. The second is foundation models in science for scientific discovery. This is less my wheelhouse, but one of the nice side effects of all this language model boom is that now we have tons of infrastructure and compute and tools and interest in running these very large models, evaluating them, studying them, and understanding how they work. And so there are a lot of problems in like the biological sciences, for example, or social sciences, where it's fairly easy to collect like medium quality data, but it's very difficult to understand all those phenomena. Protein structure prediction is the popular one, but there's, I think, a lot of other ones in psychology and genetics where you can teach models to draw correlations and reasonable causal relationships between different data points, but it's very hard for humans to go in and come up with an explanation. And so building models for these use cases and taking advantage of the tooling and the infrastructure that we've gotten to tackle those problems, I think is super interesting. The third, and the one that I'm sort of like most enthusiastically playing with around on the side, is there's a researcher named Neil Nanda. I like to read his stuff a lot, and he has this way that he puts it, which is like, we have computer programs that know how to write a sonnet, how to like write a Dr. Seuss poem. We don't know how they work. It seems like a thing that we should try to understand how they work, because it seems like it should not be possible, but yet we have these machines that do these things. A lot of the stuff that I did at the last few months of my year off was somewhat related to this. It was like trying to control how models model and generate text by interfering inside the model, by messing with model activations internally, by looking at latent spaces and embedding spaces of models and trying to pull out like, here's an embedding, we're not just doing like nearest neighbor search, but we're actually looking at like a single embedding. I mean, what do these numbers actually mean? And then I think one that's just interesting because like understanding stuff is cool. And I think it'd be really cool to look at an embedding and be like, okay, here's the number that corresponds to like whether this embedding is about cars or not. I think that's just really cool. And then more practically, I think understanding how these things will work is going to help us a lot. Like the difference between understanding how various parts of transformers work and don't is the difference between do we have better performing models or not. So I think more advances in interpretability is super interesting to follow.
Awesome. And I know you're also a very prolific writer and you're thinking about these things and talking about them. So we'll have a question and answer session, but if people want to learn more, where should they go?
I have a website, thesfs.com. It's hard to spell, but if you find me on Twitter or Google my name, it'll be there. Yeah.
Awesome.